So we're going to continue in our series of the great rabbis and their writings. Tonight is part three of the lectures on Maimonides, the Rambam. And in the first two lectures, we covered a lot of the biographical information, so we're not going to be reviewing that. But if you missed that and you want to catch up on some of the biographical information, you can go back and listen to those previous lectures. But what we're going to be doing tonight is a continuation of what we were beginning last week, which is the some reading and sampling some of the writings in the Mishneh Torah. Hi. Mishneh Torah being, welcome, being the magnum opus of the Rambam and his work of 14 volumes, which he wrote between the years 1170 and 1180. And for more information about that, you can go back to last week's lecture. But we started this last week, and we're going to begin it again this week. The final book of Maimonides in that 14-volume book, and each book is broken down into multiple sections. The final section in the final book is the Laws of Wars and Kings. The Laws of Wars and Kings. And in the last two chapters of that section, so that would be the last two chapters of the encyclopedic work called the Mishneh Torah, the last two chapters deal with the concept of Mashiach, Messiah. And this is obviously one that is needs to be understood. It's a very fascinating topic. It's one that's often misunderstood both by Jews and non-Jews. And there have been many times in Jewish history where there have been messianic movements that have, in many cases, wreaked havoc on the Jewish people, contemporary ones and ones of many hundreds of years ago. So we're going to talk about that and see what the Rambam has to say on this. Now, fascinating piece of history. For most of the decades and centuries that a Jew would pick up Maimonides' Mishneh Torah and open it and start reading it, he would not be looking at the entirety of the Mishneh Torah because there was a lot of censorship that took place. The Christian censors took a lot of the writings, a lot of the comments of the Rambam out because they were offensive to Christianity. In more recent times, this wasn't a bad call, but I guess the rabbis have decided that it's, the cat is out of the bag a little bit, and the more recent editions of the Rambam have replaced that information. Those writings were never lost. They were just taken out and recorded in separate small volumes that we kept, quietly in our drawer instead of on the bookshelf. But in the more recent editions of the Rambam, they've been returned. They've been placed back in the text of the Rambam. So what we're going to be studying tonight is the uncensored version, which includes some comments about Christianity and Islam, which I'll point out were censored from the Rambam for hundreds and hundreds of years. Okay, so let's jump back in. The Rambam's Laws of Kings and Wars, chapters 11 and 12. Okay, and what I did here in this set, I don't have an extra copy of that. Actually, I do. Oh, did you make copies? Oh, so I do have one more copy here of each, if somebody needs. Okay. Okay. Okay, good. So what I did for this one, the Rambam's Laws of Kings and Wars, chapter 11 and 12, I put the entirety of those two chapters in here. But what we're going to be doing is we're going to be studying the parts that are in bold, and we're going to be skipping over the parts that are not in bold, just because we can't do it all. It's a lot. There's a lot there, so we're going to do as much as we can. And then in the next section, which if we finish this tonight, which I hope we will, we can move on to the next section, which I want to do. Why is everybody talking? Yeah, it's hard. Nobody can hear when other people are talking. Okay, the other section is excerpts from the Rambam's Laws of Character Traits, and we're going to hopefully get to that tonight as well. Okay, so with that, let's begin chapter 11 at the beginning. In the future, and if people have questions here, make sure you ask, because I want to try to understand this as well as we can. In the future, the Rambam writes, he writes this again in 1170, the year 1170. In the future, the Messianic king will arise and renew the Davidic dynasty. So the one thing we know about Mashiach is that he is a descendant of King David. Okay, and this is a restoration of the Malchut Beit David, the kingship of David. restoring it to its initial sovereignty. Now here are the qualifications. He will build the temple and gather the dispersed of Israel. Somebody pointed out last night, I'm not sure, or last week, I don't remember who it was. I think it was maybe Judy or maybe it was Paula. Somebody pointed out, or somebody on this side of me, pointed out that it seems to be here an indication that the Rambam is of the opinion that the temple, the third temple, remember we had the first temple which was destroyed by the Babylonians, the second temple which was destroyed by the Romans. Jewish tradition says that there'll be a third temple which will be built by Mashiach, and that will be the final temple. It seems to be that the Rambam is of the opinion that that temple, that third temple, will be built by Mashiach, by man, by human beings. There are some other opinions, including a Medrash, I believe, that says that the third temple is not built by human beings, but that it just sort of descends from heaven. Okay, so the Rambam seems to be of the opinion that this is something that people will build. People will get together. When it says that he will build the temple, it doesn't mean he's going to build the whole thing with his own hands. It means he's going to have an architect and a general contractor, and he's going to have a team of workers, and it's going to be built that way.
They'll build it in Illinois.
I doubt that. Maybe Sheboygan, though. Yeah. Okay. So I know where it's going to be. You know where it's going to be. You know that in Israel. You know in the old city. You know in the that big gold dome that's there in
the
old,
right?
It's going to be right there. Yes. Because that's where the first two were. So. And he's going to gather the dispersed of Israel. Okay, the dispersed of Israel. And that's something which we see going on before our very eyes. You know, in the last 150 years, millions of Jews have returned to the land of Israel. Then in his days, the observance of all the statutes will return to their previous state. So we will see a return of Torah law. Torah law will become the governing body of law in the state of Israel, which it currently is not. We will offer sacrifices, observe the sabbatical and jubilee years according to all their particulars as described by the Torah. So it's going to be a complete restoration of the sovereignty of Torah and all the observances of the Torah. And all of the very, very many mitzvot that we cannot do today because we don't have a temple, sacrifices being the main one, will be returned to complete, full, thriving mode. Anyone who does not believe in him or does not await his coming denies not only the statements of the other prophets, but those of the Torah of Moses, our teacher. The Torah testified to his coming as Deuteronomy 30 states. Okay, and I'm just going to skip a little bit. Okay, skipping down. Okay, so these are different references in the Torah to where we see Mashiach coming. And you can look at those yourself. So I'm turning the page.
When he says to their previous state, does that mean that you get rid of all the rabbinic laws and literally revert back to just?
That's an interesting question. So there are, as we know in Judaism, there are Torah laws and there are rabbinical laws, and there's a general Talmudic principle that says that rabbinical laws cannot be revoked unless they are revoked by a Beit Din, a rabbinical court that is larger, of the same size or larger in number and stature as the one that enacted it, right? So which is why there are many rabbinical laws today which arguably may not be entirely relevant today, but nonetheless, we keep them anyway because there's no Beit Din, there's no rabbinical court around today that has the stature to revoke them. When Mashiach comes and the Sanhedrin will be restored, any of the rabbinical laws which are no longer applicable, which no longer are relevant, can be and most likely will be removed by the Sanhedrin. They'll have the power to do that, but they might not remove all of them because they won't. Some of them probably will still be very relevant. Okay, good question. Turning the page. In section 2 over here, he just says there's no need to cite proofs from the works of the prophets, for all their books are filled with mention of this matter. Section 3. One should not presume that the Messianic King must work miracles and wonders, bring about new phenomena in the world, resurrect the dead, or perform other similar deeds. This is definitely not true. Okay, I'll take this one too. Okay. So that's a point that others argue with Maimonides on. Now remember, Maimonides had more of a rationalist, less of a Kabbalistically bent view on these matters of eschatology. So, where's Bob? Huh?
Raise your hand.
Straight, straight. Oh, there he is. Normally when I say a word like eschatology, Bob usually looks at me. Okay.
I was sleeping.
Okay, fine. So, one should not presume the Messianic King must work miracles and wonders, bring about new phenomena in the world, resurrect the dead, or perform similar deeds. This is definitely not true. So the Rambam's opinion is that really nothing supernatural is going to be taking place during the Messianic era.
Who's going to do it then?
Good question. I think that I think that Hashem is going to do it, and I think, but I think, right.
The big guy.
And I think it's going to happen according to the Rambam towards the end of the period of Mashiach. Okay, and he proves this because that Rabbi Akiva, as I mentioned last week, was of the opinion that Bar Kokhba, also known as Bar Koziba, was the Mashiach. And a lot of the sages with Rabbi Akiva were behind him in that, and they said that this Bar Kokhba was the Mashiach. Bar Kokhba never did any miracles or signs or wonders. Okay, so that's his proof. So nothing necessarily supernatural is going to be taking place. Nothing out of the physical, ordinary realm of things. 4. If a king will arise from the house of David, that's a requirement. He's got to be from the house of David. Who diligently contemplates the Torah and observes its mitzvos as prescribed by the written law and the oral law as David, his ancestor, will compel all of Israel to walk in the ways of Torah and rectify the breaches in its observance and fight the wars of God, we may with assurance consider him Mashiach. So just an important point. Does anyone have one of those little things?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, from last week.
Okay, good. Can we take it? Okay. Okay, so one of the requirements is that Mashiach has to be completely committed, entirely and totally committed to Torah observance and its mitzvos. There's no such thing as anybody being a candidate for Mashiach, according to the Rambam, unless he's completely on board with all of Torah law, oral law, written law, rabbinical law, and Jewish custom, which would discount... perhaps and potentially discount many of the false messiahs that have wreaked havoc in Jewish communities throughout the millennia. Yeah.
What happens to all the people who aren't Torah observant? I mean, it sounds almost like
they become Torah observant when Mashiach comes in, and the world is filled. We'll see. The world is going to be filled with clarity and knowledge of Hashem's presence. Then everybody will come on board and say, "Oh wow, you know that's now I get it, now I get it."
But will they have to learn it, or will they feel it instinctively?
No, I mean they'll probably have to learn it. You know, there'll be yeshivas, and people will quit their jobs and go learn in yeshiva, and it's interesting. Maybe I'll share this a little later. An interesting question that I had once for a Rebbe of mine. Okay, so now we can assume that this individual is Mashiach because he's done all the things that he's needed to do so far. Then, if he succeeds in the above, meaning he manages to compel or encourage or inspire Jews to walk in the ways of God and Torah, okay, and he builds the temple in its place, and he gathers the dispersed of Israel, he is definitely Mashiach. That's it. He doesn't have to apply for the job. He doesn't have to, he doesn't need a resume. He just needs to convince all the Jews that they should keep the Torah and bring back the dispersed of Israel to the land of Israel and build the temple. Okay? Those are the requirements. He will then improve the entire world. Now this spills out. This is not just something that affects the Jewish people, but this is something that spreads out and eventually... has a major reverberations throughout the world. He will then improve the entire world, motivating all the nations to serve God together. As Zephaniah states, he's one of the prophets, "I will transform the peoples to a pure language, and they will all call upon the name of God and serve him with one purpose." So the whole world, not just the Jewish people, but the whole world, not that everyone becomes Jewish or that everybody converts, but the whole world recognizes the oneness of God and serves God according to their particular pathway, which would be, if they're not Jewish, would be the seven Noahai laws, and if they are Jewish, would be the pathway of Torah. Yeah?
You said that at this point, conversions would be prohibited?
Conversions will not be permitted. Yeah, according to the Rambam, he says elsewhere that there will no longer be accepting converts during the period of Mashiach. Because everybody's going to want to be Jewish then, you know. It's okay. Yeah. Okay.
And everyone will speak Hebrew.
I'm not sure if that's what it means by the pure language. I don't know if it means that. I think it just means that what they'll talk about and the things that will be discussed will be of a spiritual nature as opposed to, you know, the cubs and things like that. You know. Not that that's not spiritual, but you know what I'm saying.
Not to be picky here, but...
Yeah.
Previous conversions will be accepted?
Oh, yeah.
But you're just not taking anybody.
Right. Because basically, it's a discussion, but we would be too suspicious of ulterior motivation at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, if there's like 7, maybe 8 billion people in the world, 14 million Jews, it's going to be a lot of antagonism by these Noahide people saying, I would like to be like Jews.
Right, but that's the thing about Judaism, which is unique, is that because Judaism offers a pathway for every human being every human being is created in the image of God. Every human being has a possibility of connecting to the Almighty. So they won't necessarily, they might want to be Jews, but they won't have that option. But they'll be happy at least that they'll have the knowledge. They'll come to Jerusalem to seek the knowledge on how to serve God in the way that's been, you know, laid out for them. Yeah. Okay. If he did not succeed to this degree or was killed, he surely is not the Redeemer promised by the Torah. Very important line over here, okay? Mashiach has to be alive. Mashiach cannot come from the dead. Okay?
That's a biggie.
Yes. That is a biggie. Hamevin Yavin. If you know what I'm talking about, you know what I'm talking about. Rather, he should be considered as all the other proper and complete kings of the Davidic dynasty who died. Right? If someone comes along and he is the king of becomes the king, he's from the Davidic dynasty and he is a king and he starts doing all these things and he gathers, but he doesn't finish the job and he dies. He was a great Jewish leader. He was not Mashiach. God caused him to arise. Only to test the many. We're always being watched. As Daniel says, God caused him to arise. So why did this person come along then if he wasn't Mashiach? As a test. Okay? That's what he says over here. Now, go to the next paragraph. Siri, no one invited you. Okay. Next paragraph. Ready? Here we go. This is uncensored Rambam over here. What you're reading right now is something that your Bubbies and Zadies never saw. Because the Rambam that they had was censored. It's only in the last 30 or 40 years that Shapsi Frankel reintroduced these things into the Rambam, into the current text of the Rambam. But this is something that the Rambam wrote. Jesus of Nazareth, who aspired to be the Mashiach and was executed by the court, was alluded to in Daniel's prophecies. Okay. The vulgar among your people shall exalt themselves in an attempt to fulfill the vision, but they shall stumble. Says the Rambam, when Daniel prophesied that, he was referring to Jesus of Nazareth. Can there be a greater stumbling block than Christianity? All the prophets spoke of Mashiach as the Redeemer of Israel and their Savior, who would gather their dispersed and strengthen their observance of the mitzvot. In contrast, Christianity caused the Jews to be slain by the sword, their remnants to be scattered and humbled, the Torah to be altered, and the majority of the world to err and serve a God other than the Lord. Okay? Those are not really qualities of Mashiach. But, says the Rambam...
Excuse, is this that paragraph written by Rambam?
Yes. Yes, it was taken out for many, many hundreds of years by the Christian censors, but it was placed back in. But nonetheless, God has a good sense of humor, says the Rambam. Nevertheless, the intent of the creator of the world is not within the power of man to comprehend. Meaning something good came out of Christianity, which he's going to describe. For his ways are not our ways, and his thoughts are not our thoughts. Ultimately, all the deeds of Jesus of Nazareth, and this is also now reintroduced but previously censored, and that Ishmaelite who arose after him, who is that referring to? Muhammad, right? So ultimately, all the deeds of Jesus, now don't forget the Rambam himself was somebody who was tortured and suffered miserably at the hands of radical Islam. He and his family were running away from radical Islam for many, many years. They hid in a cave for 8 years. His family was, many of his family members and members of his community were murdered by this Almohad sect of radical Islam. So he's very familiar with this. So ultimately, all the deeds of Jesus of Nazareth and the Ishmaelite who arose after him will only serve to prepare the way for Mashiach's coming and the improvement of the entire world, motivating the nations to serve God together, as Zephaniah states. I will transform the peoples to a pure language. We saw that. How will this come about? The entire world has already become filled with the mention of Mashiach, Torah, and mitzvot. In other words, what Christianity and Islam did is they paved the way for the coming of Mashiach, because even though they are not authentic, according to the Rambam, presentations of Jewish thought, but they did contain within them the ideas of a Mashiach, a messianic period, of serving God, of monotheism on some level or another. So because the world has already become filled with the mention of Mashiach, Torah, mitzvot, these matters have been spread to the furthermost islands and to many stubborn-hearted nations. They discuss matters in the mitzvot of the Torah, saying, these mitzvot were true, but they were already negated in the present age. They were already negated in the present age, and they're not applicable for all time. Others say, implied in the... Okay, you get the idea over here. When the true messianic king will arise and prove successful, his position will be exalted and uplifted. They will all return and realize that their ancestors endowed them with a false heritage, and their prophets and ancestors caused them to err. But they'll be on board enough because of the Christianity and Islam that they believed in, that they'll be willing to and close enough to recognize and appreciate Mashiach when he comes and what his purpose is. And that is the role that Christianity and Islam played in history, according to the Rambam. It's very interesting how that worked itself out. So that's
monotheism.
Monotheism, right. And not only monotheism, but the ideas of serving God, that there are commandments, that there is a messianic era coming, right? These are things that Christians and Muslims all believe. And that's because... And that has paved the way so that when Mashiach comes, it's not going to be a brand new idea that they've never heard of before. All they're going to have to do is readjust themselves and realize that their ancestors had endowed them with a false heritage and their prophets and ancestors had caused them to err, but at least they were close enough that they'll be able to get on board, so to speak, when that happens. Okay? That's chapter 11. And... let's just do some of chapter 12, but not all of it. Any questions so far? Yeah.
So Christianity says you have the chance on this earth, but if you don't, you go to burn in hell.
Okay. That's true.
It's a little bit different.
Yes. Yes, very different. But nonetheless, they have a concept that will allow them to be able to readjust or recalibrate to the Jewish concept when it becomes revealed, because it's not so far away. It's not coming from nowhere. They're not polytheists. They're not pagans. They're not people that believe in the sun god and the moon god anymore. These are people that have a basic basic
foundation
of monotheism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we're going to a Teret HaKohanim, right, on our trip?
Yes.
We're still going?
Yes.
Okay.
I hope.
So this is a yeshiva in the Old City in Jerusalem that prepares their students for the Third Temple, for the sacrifices.
They do that. Yes, they do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because when Mashiach, you know, they're Kohanim. This is the yeshiva for Kohanim. So they know what they're. So they know what to do. Yeah. We're going to leave you there for a month so you can. Right? You're a Kohen, aren't you?
No, excuse me.
I thought you were a Kohen.
Me.
Are you a Kohen? No. Oh. Well, it's not going to work. Okay.
Maybe you can get another trip.
Yeah.
But the three religions that you've talked about, far and away, the Jews are less exposed to the idea of the Mashiach.
Yes, that's true. Ironically, but yeah, that's true. Definitely. Okay. Here we go, chapter 12. Now we talk about what things are going to look like then. Do not presume that in the Messianic age, any facet of the world's nature will change or there will be innovations in the work of creation. Rather, the world will continue according to its pattern. Nothing changes. There's no supernatural miracles. The physical world remains what it is. It's not a different age where, you know, where people are you know, living outside of their bodies, or there are all kinds of spiritual miracles that are taking place. According to the Rambam, it's a regular thing. It's just that, he'll explain. Although Isaiah states, now he's going to ask a question, because it says the famous quote from Isaiah, which I believe is on the UN building, the wolf will dwell with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the young goat. These words are a metaphor and a parable. It doesn't mean literally that, you know, these animals are going to befriend one another. The interpretation of the prophecy is as follows. Israel will dwell securely together with the wicked Gentiles who are likened to a wolf and a leopard, as in the prophecy of Jeremiah. A wolf from the wilderness shall spoil them, and a leopard shall stalk their cities. In other words, no longer will these nations, these evil nations, try to destroy us, as they had during the times of the Crusades and during the times of radical Islam and during the Holocaust and etc. But they will no longer treat us that way, but they will respect us. They will return to the true faith and no longer steal or destroy. Rather, they will eat permitted food at peace with Israel, as Isaiah states, the lion will eat straw like an ox. Okay. Similarly, other messianic prophecies of this nature are metaphors. In the messianic era, everyone will realize which matters were implied by the metaphors and which allusions they contained. And here it goes. He says that our sages taught. When he says our sages, he's quoting the Talmud. There will be no difference between the current age and the messianic era except the emancipation from our subjugation to the Gentile kingdoms. That's the only difference, that we'll be free to have our own, completely owned government to reign in Israel according to Torah law, and there won't be any UN or any other nations out there telling us what we can or cannot do. The simple interpretation of the prophet's words appear to imply that the war of Gog and Magog will take place at the beginning of the Messianic age. Okay, that's a whole complicated thing. I don't think I really want to go into that. Talks about the coming of Eliyahu, Elijah. But then he says you shouldn't spend too much time thinking about these things. And the last paragraph on this page.
We were successful at that, weren't we?
Yeah. The last paragraph. Similarly, one should not try to determine the appointed time for Mashiach's coming. Don't try to figure out when he's coming. You should just wait for it to happen. And yeah.
I'm sorry, where was that?
That was at the, yeah. By the way, I wanted to number the pages this time, but for the weirdest reason I can't figure out on my Word, the page numbering option is not available. Does anyone know how to fix that?
Is it 10?
Yeah.
Windows 10?
Yeah,
Windows. It's up there somewhere.
I know, it's there, but it's not clickable.
Oh,
huh? Corrupted, I think, yeah.
In the age of the Mashiach.
That won't have that problem anymore.
So Rambam is saying, it seems that he's saying that we should not be actively working toward?
No, good question. Good question. He's saying that we shouldn't obsess ourselves with what it's going to be like and what it's going to look like and what's going to be happening then and that how it's going to play itself out and when it's going to be. But certainly, we should be focusing on doing the types of things that we need to make this happen.
Right, because I just thought it was interesting that he doesn't list any of the things, at least in here, in this particular reading, the things that we need to do to make it come speedily and in our days, as they say.
It's true. He doesn't. I remember once I'll never forget this. I was at the Kotel, and I bumped into one of my teachers, Mutzi Berger, and he said to me, he saw me down there. He said, "Hey, Dave, what are you doing?" So I said, "I'm waiting for Mashiach." And he said, "No, Dave, got it all wrong. Mashiach's waiting for you." That's what he said. So, right, and our kids learn this in school. You know, every time they do a mitzvah, they're building a brick in the temple, and that's the idea. Like, that's what we focus on. In section 3, he talks about the role of Mashiach in determining which tribe each person comes from. Right now, we don't know which, unless you're a Kohen or a Levi, you're from the tribe of Levites. Otherwise, you don't know what tribe you come from. It could be Yehuda, it could be Binyamin, and we don't know where we come from. We don't know who's necessarily which tribe we belong to, so that's one of the things that Mashiach is going to do. Yeah. Oh, sorry, yeah.
Is there a concept that in the Messianic age, it's a period of time during which your study and knowledge of Torah is facilitated, but isn't that in proportion to the investment that you make before Mashiach arrives with regard to establishing a base and commitment to learning?
So, I mean, for sure it's going to, the more, and that actually relates to something I was going to share with you earlier. It's an interesting question. You know, just kind of going on a little bit of a tangent. A little bit of the history of the what's referred to as the Kiruv movement. The Kiruv movement is kind of defined by the last, let's say, 40 years or so, beginning with Chabad and Eshet Torah, the outreach movement, where the Baal Tshuva movement, right, where in the last 50 years or so, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of people who grew up without any real Jewish background returned to their traditions, returned to their roots, and became more observant. It really, you know, the Six-Day War in many ways sparked that consciousness. And Jews in America and definitely in the former Soviet Union and throughout the world began returning in large, massive numbers, doing tshuva, becoming observant and returning to their Jewish background.
Just to continue on that, 67 being somewhat of a turn point, but the Holocaust being the worst disaster, probably worse than the Roman disaster, because we lost more people killed. And by mid-1944, the Irgun and the Lehi and the revolt against the British was already starting. And we beat the British, then beat 5 Arab armies.
Right.
So we're in a Messianic age.
That's right. That's for sure true. That's for sure true.
There's no depression within Jewry now, and this is after the Holocaust.
Right. It's an incredible thing.
We're optimistic.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
It's
miraculous. It's and that sparked the Baal Tshuva movement. And now there are, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, maybe 100,000, who knows how many. So, but an interesting thing has happened in the last 10 years, and that is that the Baal Tshuva movement has come to an end. Really, it's not happening like it used to happen. It's not happening where kids on college campuses are becoming observant and families are, you know, moving from the suburbs into the religious neighborhoods. It's just really, really, really kind of stopped.
Yes, but excuse me. There's lately all over the world a lot of non-Jewish people, Christians, who want to become a Jew and become.
That's true. That is true. That is happening. That is true.
It was Jocelyn. I couldn't.
Yes.
Could you repeat?
Yeah. That there is a movement going on of non-Jews who are interested in conversion in much larger numbers than any other time, you know, in recent Jewish history. That's true. But among the Jews, the Baal Tshuva movement has really almost come to a complete halt. And well, let me just finish this point. So I was speaking to somebody in a very big rabbi in Israel. And I asked him, like, you know, my job as a Kiruv professional, as an outreach professional, would have been, you know, 20 years ago, the question would have been, you know, how many Baal Tshuva families are there in your community now? You know, how many people have become from, that would be the matrix that a outreach organization would judge its success or failure based on how many Baal Tshuvas, you know, 20, 30, 40, okay, you're doing okay, you know. But nowadays, that's just not happening. So I asked this very important person, you know, what's the role? What's our role now? What's our role? The role of people that are out in the field doing outreach. He said, it's no longer to make people from. Your job is not to make people from. He said, your job is to create Jews who have a strong enough identity that they can make it to the finish line. So the Mashiach comes and says, raise your hand if you're Jewish, they'll raise their hand. Wow. That they'll stand up for that. They'll stand up and be counted and say, yes, I'm Jewish. And that's really all we're trying to salvage at this point. You know, if somebody becomes more observant along the way, hey, that's great. They became more identified. They became more connected. They became about tshuva. But that's not really the goal at this point. Really, at this point, the goal is just to see that Jews should be enough identified that when Mashiach comes along and says, who's with us? Who's still here? Who's still standing? You know, we'll all raise our hands. So that's obviously, the more connected you are and the more learning you've done going into that period, going back to your question, Les, the more you will be able to draw from, the more background, the more basis, the more foundation you'll have. So this would be a reason why coming here on Tuesday nights would be a very prudent choice, because when Mashiach is going to come, you'll be able to have a lot of knowledge and a lot of background and a lot to share, as opposed to people who might not know anything but will still be Jewish, but might not have
any. Is he committed to a Tuesday night?
I think he's coming. I think he's going to come on a Tuesday night for sure.
Yeah. Wednesday's not going to work.
No. Wednesdays are hard, you know. Wednesdays there's soccer and there's...
Could he give us like a couple weeks' notice? Or
I don't know if it's going to work that way. By the way, everyone should buy some property in Israel before he comes, because the real estate is going to skyrocket. You think I'm kidding? No, I'm not joking. There's such a thing called Mashiach apartments. People are already buying them. People are buying them in Jerusalem, Mashiach apartments. Now, granted, you have to have a little bit of guilt behind you if you're going to buy a Mashiach apartment. But no one says you have to buy three apartments in Mamilla and knock down the walls and But people are buying Mashiach apartments left and right, because seriously, when Mashiach comes, not only will the real estate skyrocket, you won't be able to buy any land. There'll be no way to buy land in Israel. It'll be impossible.
You probably should buy yeshivas too.
Buy everything. Buy it up.
The yeshiva's ready.
Yeah.
Geared up for when
for sure.
We're not all going to be in Israel, or we are going to all be in Israel.
Only if you go.
Raise your hand.
You got to go. Nothing supernatural. You're not just going to... There's no beam me up, Scotty. You have to go.
Yeah? This is like the lottery. In order to win, you got to
play. I had a lunch. Last time I was in Israel, I spent Shabbos in Hebron. And I had a Shabbos meal with one of the original founding settlers in Hebron. His name is Baruch Marzel. He's a very interesting person. You should look him up if you want to find out about him. And the very first thing he said, we sat down, he made Kiddush, and then he looked at me in the eyes, and he says, Mashiach's coming, right? And I said, yes. He said, and you're going to watch it happen on television. That's what he said to me. That's what he said. Yeah.
That's my point.
Yes.
I was just wondering when you said about the property, if we're going back to all the statutes that are in the Torah, then we're all already assigned a piece of land in Israel from our forefathers, mm-hmm. so that it's already taken care of.
It's a good point. It's a good point, but I don't know if that means, okay, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure how that works out exactly. That's a very good point. The ancestral lands will be returned. The people that are from Shevet Binyamin will be in the area of Binyamin, but I don't necessarily know what's going to happen. You know, does that mean that everyone's going to get an individual parcel of land, or does that just mean I'm going to belong to this tribe, and this tribe is going to be given this section of Israel, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to be handed a keys to an apartment in Ramat Beit Shemesh. I don't know.
But, maybe you get the rent, so you could rent someplace else.
Maybe. I don't know. It's a good question. But there are people that discuss that. I'm not up on that. But it's a good point. Yeah.
This idea, backing it up a couple steps, this idea of identified Jews. Okay, so that's great. We want to create as many identified Jews as we can who will raise their hand and say yes. But the problem is, even if this generation and this class is identified, it has to be transferred. And Mashiach may not come in our lifetime. It may not come in our children's lifetime. So we still have to worry about transferring that identity adequately. We can't just do it ourselves. And I think that's a critical factor into this whole Kiruv idea.
Totally. And there's only one way, by the way, to perpetuate Judaism from one generation to the next.
Teach it.
Live it. Not teach it. Live it. Live it. It's the only way. It's the only way. I mean, I'm not saying this. It's fact. It's history. Everyone knows. The only way to keep it going from one generation to the next is you live it. If you don't, It doesn't stick. Doesn't continue.
Excuse me. I would like to say something. Kids who come from an Orthodox family, very religious, these days with the internet and everything, and they're traveling all over the world and everything, what's happening is that now they know the Jew inside, they have the Emunah, but they don't do nothing because they connect with so many people from different people of the world and different religion that Shabbat and the holiday.
Yeah, it's a very, very challenging, difficult time to be a religious Jew. You know, the question, we've discussed this here before many times. What is it easier or harder? Is it harder to be a Jew in 2017 in Deerfield, or is it harder to be a Jew in 1890 in the shtetl in Russia?
I think it's both the same.
So each one has its challenges, you know. Yeah. But it's very, now you have everything you could ever imagine. You have yeshivas, you have kosher restaurants, you have mikvahs, you have, sukkahdepot.com. You have everything you could possibly ever want. But at the same time, like Mrs. Pollock is saying, the challenges and the challenges of living an authentic, committed Jewish life with the internet is very, very hard. Yeah.
And also I have a question, very important, my question. It is true that for the Mashiach to come, he's waiting that every single Jew will do one Shabbat in the same time?
Not exactly, no. There is something in the Talmud that says that if all the Jewish people were to keep two Shabbats,
yes,
that the Mashiach would come. But it doesn't mean that has to happen in order for Mashiach to come. That would just be one way to bring... That was why this idea of the Shabbos project was, was trying to get all the Jews to keep Shabbat, but for two Shabbos is... Yeah.
When did you have that conversation with the rabbi?
Recently,
if you were to change the... I'm sorry, this is a real aside, but a lot of the people who don't come to these classes don't because they're afraid you're going to try and make them Orthodox. And if you changed your focus or sent that out, that vibe out.
That is the vibe that we sent out. That's the only vibe we send out. And if I tell them, don't worry, come, I'm not going to make you Orthodox, then they're going to think, oh, he's really going to make us Orthodox. Allie wanted to write in her class, in a friendly, non-judgmental environment. You can't write non-judgmental environment because then I know you think it's going to be judgment, right? So, but that, of course, that's the vibe. That's what L'Chaim Center is. People, it's sad, but most Jewish people are not interested. There's other things that are more interesting to them. That's all. It's just a matter of interest and priority.
Well, in the half full and half empty, however, there are far more people that are involved because of outreach than... that have ever been.
For sure.
It's been a hugely successful.
For sure, but it's not really. It's for every outreach organization that's, connecting with 100, 200, 300 Jews, there are thousands and thousands of Jews that are assimilating at a much faster pace and that are losing their Jewish identity than the other way. It's the trend is going in the negative direction. All you have to do is look at the Pew. All you have to do is look at the Pew report, and we can confirm that. Okay.
Excuse me.
Yeah. Well, let's finish. Let's finish. We have a lot to cover here. Okay. Four. This is important. The sages and the prophets did not yearn for the Messianic era in order to have dominion over the entire world, says the Rambam. We're not looking over here to rule over the Gentiles, to be exalted by the nations, or to eat, drink, and celebrate. It's not about that. It's not about power. It's not about lust. It's not about anything. There's only Mashiach is about one thing. Rather, they desire to be free, to involve themselves in Torah and wisdom without any pressure or disturbances, so that they would merit the world to come, as explained in Hilchos Tshuva. Says the Rambam, the purpose of the period of Mashiach is it's the last period of human history. Before the world shuts down and what's called the Olam Haba begins, okay? And it's a chance for people that are there to be able to up their level of connection to Hashem, because once the world, once human history as we know it ends, and Olam Haba begins for eternity, the world to come begins for eternity, whatever, whoever you are, whatever level you've achieved or accomplished is the level that you will remain on for eternity. So the period of Mashiach is a little like gift at the end of history where people can take themselves and literally just, you know, take a quantum leap in their level of spiritual connection, awareness, knowledge, and development, spiritual Jewish development, so that then when the world to come begins, they'll be on a completely different level.
So it's the last time to do mitzvahs.
It's the last time to do mitzvahs, but it's like a super-powered opportunity because the world's going to, all the pressures that take us away from mitzvahs, the obligation to earn money and the obligation of the and governments and subjugation from foreign governments and oppression and anti-Semitism and all the things that for thousands of years have prevented us from dedicating ourselves fully to Torah and mitzvahs are going to no longer be there. The Yetzirah also begins to slowly release its grasp over us, and we're able to be more. The balance shifts a little bit to our slowly, gradually to our spiritual side, so that we don't have to fight the pressure of the Yetzirah either. So it's all going to be weighted and loaded for us to be able to supercharge our spiritual level. Okay, which is why, by the way, I'll take a question in a second. You could ask a question if that's gewaldic, right? That's such an amazing opportunity. What about people like the Chafetz Chaim and the Vilna Gaon and Sarah Schneira and all the great, great, great Jewish people who are not going to merit that, right? They're not going to be able to be alive during that period of time. So that's what Techiyas HaMeisim is all about. That's why bodies and souls come back together during this period of time of Mashiach to be able to experience. People, tzaddikim, great people that have passed away, will come back there and be able to experience that period of time called Mashiach. Yeah, Bruce.
Is Hashem almost holding us out like a carrot to kind of bring us closer than
well? Yeah, I mean this is the goal, right? This is where we're trying to get to, and we could do it. We could do it tomorrow. We could do it today. You know, the main thing that's holding us back is disunity among Jewish people. That the second temple was destroyed because of sinat chinam, baseless hatred. The Talmud says that any generation that doesn't merit to see the temple rebuilt is it's because they're perpetuating the sin of baseless hatred. If we Jews could figure out how to get along and love each other and respect each other and honor each other, even if we're different, even if things if we don't look the same or we don't speak the same or we don't observe the same, then Mashiach will come and we'll be able to have this experience together. That's what we need to do. That's what we need to get to. That's what we need to focus on.
Odd question. With the resurrection of the dead, I mean, like, it's only for Jews that are going to be resurrected? Because, like, they're already talking about world overpopulation. All the dead.
Yeah. Techiyas HaMeisim is a Jewish thing. Resurrection, yeah. That's for tzaddikim of the previous generation will be brought back to be able to experience the period of Mashiach.
Isn't it everybody? Not just the
not everybody. No, only the...
Not mom and dad.
The righteous. I don't. I mean, I'm not. You and I can't say who's righteous and who's not righteous.
Only the righteous.
Yes, Techiyas HaMeisim is for the righteous. Now, what is? I don't know what righteous means. Righteous means that you know you had to have a long white beard and pay us.
Hopefully, the bar is lowered because
I don't know. We don't know exactly what's.
The whole idea of being buried in Israel is because.
Huh?
Well, that's true. But that's part of it because yeah, the rolling.
Otherwise,
that whole,
we're all rolling.
Yeah, that whole rolling thing.
That's
okay. That's part of it, why cremation is prohibited. Okay. And here we go. In that era. Okay, so again, we're talking about number five. We're talking about, says the Rambam now, these are things that will be make our lives much more spiritually oriented. In that era, there'll be neither famine nor war. Envy or competition for good will flow in abundance. And all the delights will be freely available as dust. The occupation of the entire world will be solely to know God. Therefore, Jews will be great sages and know the hidden matters, grasping the knowledge of their Creator according to the full extent of human potential. As Isaiah states, the world will be filled with the knowledge of God as the waters cover the ocean bed. And then the Rambam says, this completes Hilchos Malachim, the entire text. Blessed be he who spoke and the world came into being as a whole with all of its particulars. This concludes the 14th book of the Book of Judges. It contains 5 halachas and 81 chapters. In the entire text, there are 83 halachot, 982 chapters, complete and perfect, with praise to God, creator of the world. End of the Mishneh Torah. We just did the whole Mishneh Torah in one night. It's amazing. That's what happens when you start in the last two chapters. Okay. So that is that. It's a very interesting discussion. Hold on to these. You can study them some more. I guess it probably doesn't make all that much sense to start. Let's just talk about what we're going to do the next 2 weeks. And we're going to wrap up the Rambam this week and next week. Next week and the week after. So next week what we're going to do is we're going to study the excerpts from the Rambam's Laws of Character Traits. He has a 6-chapter fabulous, incredible, fascinating work called Hilchot Deot, the Laws of Character Traits. A lot of what's called Musar, a lot of contemporary Musar is drawn from the Rambam's Hilchot Deot. It's similar in many ways to Pirkei Avos. It's very, very good, solid advice, not just about character traits, but also about habits, how one should eat, how one should sleep, how one should involve themselves in marital intimacy, different character traits that one should acquire, different character traits that one should avoid. It's 6 chapters long. This time I took excerpts. So you see I started in chapter 2. I did section 1, 2, 3, and then I skipped to 7. Because there's no way to do everything. And then I went to chapter 3, and I did a few sections from chapter 3 and a few sections from chapter 4, skipping, you see, 4, 8, 13, right? It's all available. You can go to Chabad.org. The entire Mishneh Torah is there in translation. So if you want to, if you want to go there and learn it more, it's worth learning the whole thing. So next week we'll try to do this. And then the final week, which will be 2 weeks from tonight, on the Rambam, we're going to take a little bit of a different twist, and we're going to talk about a letter that he wrote that literally changed the course of history. It was a letter that he wrote to the community in Yemen. It's called the Igeret HaTeiman, the Epistle to the Yemenite Jews. He saved the entire community of Yemen with one letter. There are thousands of Yemenite Jews today that live mostly in Israel. They all owe their existence. They all are around today because of this letter that the Rambam wrote to them. And we'll see a different side of the Rambam, his role as being the world leader of Jewry, as not just a halachic writer and a codifier, but also somebody who concerned himself with the well-being of all the Jewish people and all the Jewish communities, and the hope and the support, the tikvah, the yearning that he was able to give to these Yemenite Jews in a terrible, terrible time in their history was what allowed them to survive through this devastating period of history and allowed them to continue for 900 years in isolation until they came to Israel about 100 years ago. So we're going to learn that Igeret HaTeiman, the letter, the epistle to the Yemenite Jews, that'll be the 2 weeks from tonight, and then that will wrap up the section on Maimonides. Okay? Good. Yes. Oh, yes. So, if anybody would like to volunteer to stick around now for about, if we do this right, we could do it in 15 minutes. So we're going to set up for Shabbos.